rise. The Court of Appeals, Division 1 is now in session.
Please be seated. Good morning. Today is June 12th, 2025. This is time set for oral argument in our case number CACV 240776, Walden et al. Versus Mesas Unified School District number 4 et al. Out of respect for counsel and to avoid any embarrassment for anyone in attendance in the courtroom, please make sure your cell phone is on silent. Each side is allocated 20 minutes for oral argument, although you are not required to use all of your time. If appellant wishes to reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal, you're free to do so, but you need to keep track of your own time at the podium. The clock on the podium reflects your total remaining minutes. These proceedings are being live streamed and will be available on our website for viewing. With that in mind, please make sure to speak into the microphone when presenting and introduce yourself. Please keep in mind, as you present your case, we have read the briefs, studied the record, and discussed the case in conference. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is James Rogers from America First Legal, representing the appellants Rachel Walden and Jane Doe in this matter against Mesa Unified School District Number 4, which is also known as Mesa Public Schools, or MPS. I plan to reserve about 3 or 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case involves the unlawful implementation of a policy by Mesa Public Schools which facilitates the social gender transition of students without parental knowledge or consent. It's a policy that requires school employees to actively conceal this transition from parents. It requires school employees to have private conversations with students about matters of human sexuality without notification to parent or parental knowledge or consent. And it requires school employees who are not licensed mental health practitioners to diagnose mental health disorders and to treat them without parental knowledge or consent. Two plaintiffs sued to challenge that policy, first Rachel Walden, who's a member of the school board of MPS, and then second, the pseudonymously named plaintiff Jane Doe, whose daughter Megan Doe was a student at an MPS junior high where school officials actively encouraged her to socially transition her gender in school, to change her name to a male name, to use male pronouns, and to actively conceal all of this from her parents. The Superior Court erred when it dismissed the plaintiff's first amended complaint with prejudice, and there's five reasons for this. The first is that it erred dismissing the complaint for lack of standing and refusing leave to amend any perceived lacks, defects in the standing, in the pleading for standing. First of all, the court erred because the standard for standing is more forgiving in a special action. Arizona Public Integrity Alliance makes that clear. It says that the plaintiff only needs a beneficial
counsel,
interest.
To me, the standing argument is different for both of the plaintiffs. And to simply throw out generic standing, whatever, is not very helpful. If you could focus your argument on why Ms. Walden has standing and why Ms. Doe has standing, it would be very beneficial to the court.
Absolutely, Your Honor. Governing Board Member Walden has standing because she has a distinct, so even if we have the higher level of a distinct and palpable injury, she still has standing because she suffered that injury because she's been deprived of the ability to vote on the school policy.
And when was this policy adopted?
The dates are hazy in my mind right now, Your Honor. It's been in place for years.
Okay, so and when was she elected?
She was elected in 2022.
So the policy was adopted before her election. So how is she injured by the adoption of the policy?
Because the school continues to implement a policy that's never been voted on. So long as
the
that policy is...
We'll call them the guidelines. What the superintendent promulgated.
Correct.
Okay. So does the board ever vote on those guidelines?
It's legally required to. It never has. It was never voted on before Governing Board Member Walden came out.
How is it legally required? What chapter and verse can you quote on that? How so?
Arizona statutes require that the school board, the school district is the school board, legally speaking. So any policy by the school board has to be adopted.
A policy, but what about implementing policy, procedures, guidelines? These are called guidelines.
Correct. And the school board has adopted a policy that empowers the superintendent to implement guidelines to to promulgate guidelines to implement school board policies.
And the policy, in fact, okay, so how, but what is, again, what is the her right to actually have a vote on those guidelines then?
Well, our argument is that those are not just guidelines. There's no policy that it's implementing. There's nothing that the board's adopted that empowers her with the authority to adopt those guidelines. The appellees have argued that some generic anti-discrimination policies confer this broad authority on her, but when she actually implemented, when she actually promulgated those guidelines, she never cited those as the justification, as the policy that empowered her to do that.
But what did Walden do to try to rectify that? I mean, as a school board member, she sort of supervises the superintendent in a way. And so was there a move for a vote to reconsider the policies or review the policies? Because we're not seeing that anywhere in the pleadings.
In our briefing, we did talk about this, that we offered to the Superior Court, we asked for leave to amend to provide those details. It's not in the appellate record because it wasn't in the complaint, but we in our briefing to the Superior Court and in our briefs to this court, the briefs mention that she did make multiple attempts to have it brought to a vote and was denied every time, and
okay,
we requested
okay.
leave to amend
but
to add those
facts.
But
that's what happens when you're on a board, is you're one vote. And so the rest of the board voted no. And so you're saying that she gets a bigger voice than the rest of the members of the board?
To be clear, the board never voted not to put it on the agenda. She requested, the chair selects items for the agenda, and the chair just never put it on the agenda.
But none of those facts are in the record.
Correct, but we did ask for leave to amend, and we're in the court denied to leave to
would
amend.
Would it matter? I mean, seriously, would it matter? She says, Mr. Chairman, I would like you to place this on. He says, I'm exercising my discretion that I have as a board, as the chair of the board, and why does she get to trump that?
She cannot force the chair to bring an item to the agenda for a vote, but by the same token, the chair cannot unilaterally impose a policy by colluding with the superintendent without a vote of the board. So that's where the harm is because if there's a policy being implemented by the school district, all five board members have a right to vote on it. It'd be as if the clerk of the legislature transmitted to the governor a bill that had never been voted on by the body. Each individual legislator would have standing to challenge that because the procedures required to be followed for that in this case the bill, and in this case the
let me follow up then. The policy was passed before she came onto the board, and the way I stand to the record, most of the guidelines were in place before she came onto the board. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. But without a board vote.
Regardless, it's in place. So why would she have standing to challenge what past boards and policy have been determined as a board member?
That would imply there's some sort of doctrine of adverse possession for illegal activities by a school board. The school board can't implement an illegal policy, and then the voters vote for new people who oppose that policy, and then they can't challenge
so
it.
So are you advocating that every time a new board member comes onto a board, that the entire, everything that the board has previously done needs to be re-voted on?
Absolutely not, because this is not a policy that the board ever did. That's the point. These guidelines were promulgated without the board's consent. If the board had voted on it, obviously she would not have the authority to she would not have standing to sue. And that's the distinction here, is because the board never did it.
But does it matter if we conclude that Walden does not have standing, if we conclude that Doe does have standing in the case?
Correct. Only one plaintiff.
Does it make it really a difference to your case?
It does not, because only one plaintiff has to have standing for the case to move forward, and Plaintiff Doe does have standing, and that's something the court glossed over, the Superior Court glossed over, is that she suffers ongoing injury because the school continues to conceal the full extent of the activities, that the conversations they had with her daughter.
Let's talk about whether this was a timely lawsuit or timely special action complaint, because I believe the district has argued, I know the district has argued that it was barred by the statute of limitations, and the Superior Court agreed with that, correct?
Correct.
Why is that wrong?
Because at this stage of a motion to dismiss, the Superior Court was supposed to make all factual inferences in the plaintiff's favor. And as our briefing clearly shows, the time at which making all those inferences in the plaintiff's favor, when her cause of action would have accrued, was in May of 2023, which is when she discovered that the school had ignored all of her instructions about not continuing to promote the social gender transition of her daughter in school. And she heard her daughter's orchestra teacher announce in front of a full auditorium, calling her daughter by a male name. And so for that, from December until May, she had no idea that the school was continuing to ignore her instructions. And so that's when the date of accrual should be assumed for purposes of this motion. And of course, there would need to be fact findings.
Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, okay, I read in your briefing that you take the position that the statute of limitations, one year statute of limitation under 812.820, does not even apply. Is that still your position?
We argue that it does not apply to Superintendent Forless because she's acting outside the scope of her authority, and there's a case law that we cite that the one-year statute does not apply when the government official is acting outside the scope.
You're not contending that it does not apply to... Sorry, it's double negative. Is it your position that it does apply to Doe's claim?
We concede that it applies to the claim against the school district, but not against Superintendent Forless.
You're conceding that claims for...
I didn't hear the last answer. You're conceding it applies to the board, the school district, but not to the superintendent?
Correct.
Okay, and why is that?
It applies to the board because the board's a public entity, and so the one-year statute applies. We contend that it's not applied to Superintendent Forless because, and we cite that the case McLeod versus State of Arizona Department of Public Safety, which held that the one-year statute does not apply when the public official is not acting within the scope of their duties, and because the whole claim here is that the policy is unlawful, at least at this point for motion to dismiss phase, the four-year statute would apply. And if, after further fact-finding, the court found that she was acting within the scope of her authority, then of course the one-year would apply to Superintendent Forless as well, but that has to wait for trial.
I'd like to ask you a question, and that is, it's a hypothetical. Why wouldn't any parent in the Mesa Public School District who has a child in the Mesa Public School District, why wouldn't they be able to sue to enjoin the policy, the guidelines? Can they? Do they have standing to sue?
Yes, every parent who has a child subject to the guidelines has standing to sue because
they're
all suffering.
When does that accrue? That right to sue, when does it accrue?
It would accrue when the student becomes subject to the policy. So for any new student moving in, it accrue once the student was enrolled. We also make an argument as far as applicability statute of limitations that in this case...
Wait a minute. How would a parent know? Because the way I understand the guidelines, there's a concealment.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, let me amend that answer. It's when the parent discovers that the policy applies to their child. And like I was saying, we also argue that the statute should be told in this case because of the fraudulent concealment. And there's case law about fraudulent concealment, which we cited. The appellee said that the case that the appellant cited was based on professional malpractice against doctors. But that same principle in that same case, Walk, I believe is the case, has been applied in other contexts, in contracts and real estate purchases and other things like that. And so when there's fraudulent concealment, especially when there's a relationship of trust, such as a school caring for parents' children, then the statute is told, should be told, because of that relationship of trust.
Plaintiff Doe's requested relief for perspective, because she's not asking for damages.
Correct.
She wants prospective relief, as in don't apply these guidelines to my child. Does the statute of limitations apply for prospective relief?
It does not. And that we make the
limitation. You just said it applied, so...
I'm sorry, Your Honor. There's multiple arguments on the statute of limitations, and we actually make this argument in our brief, is that for declaratory judgment actions, it's an open question whether, if it's a pure declaratory judgment action asking only for prospective relief, whether the statute applies. An argument is that it should not, and that this court should clarify that, and this is a perfect vehicle to do so. Once again, I believe cited some cases where this court decided not to apply that standard, but those were cases that weren't pure declaratory judgment actions. There was money damages and other things involved.
So you haven't touched on the parent's Bill of Rights much yet. How does that affect standing here?
Thank you, Your Honor. I actually wanted to quote from the Parents' Bill of Rights because it confers broad standing on plaintiffs. Let me get the exact language here.
Not Walden, because she does not have a child within the district.
Correct, Your Honor. This is only as to plaintiff Doe. But what the Parents' Bill of Rights says, and this is ARS 1-601E, is it says that a parent may bring suit against a governmental entity or official described in this subsection based on any violation of the statutory rights set forth in this chapter or any other action that interferes with or usurps the fundamental right of parents to direct the upbringing, education, health care, and mental health of their children. And so therefore, under the Parents' Bill of Rights, Plaintiff Doe clearly has standing because the statute confers much broader standing than the normal distinct and palpable injury standard. It's any violation, she has standing to sue. And because the statute of limitations should not apply to her. And one other basis for that I wanted to talk about was ongoing misconduct. That's also an open question under Arizona law, whether the statute of limitations for public officials applies when there's ongoing misconduct. And we've cited some unpublished cases on that. And this would also be a perfect vehicle to clarify that in a situation such as this, where there's this ongoing misconduct, public officials shouldn't be able to use it as a shield to avoid responsibility for their unlawful actions.
But do you concede that there's nothing in the Parents' Bill of Rights that supersedes the statute of limitations statute?
Correct, Your Honor. And then one other issue I wanted to talk about was the appellees talked about whether Superintendent Forlis was named in her official capacity or individual capacity, whether the statute of limitations for public officials should apply because the plaintiffs sued her in her official capacity. And the plaintiffs, the appellants, have made the argument from the beginning that if there's some sort of pleading deficiency, that can be easily fixed through amendment, and the court erred by not allowing amendment if that's a problem. But the cases cited for the proposition that this distinction matters are Section 1983 cases under federal law, where the distinction matters because the plaintiffs are seeking money damages. In cases like this where there's no money damages, the distinction really doesn't matter anyway. In the McLeod case, which we cited in our briefs, it goes into that, where the plaintiffs pled as if they were suing the DPS officer in his official capacity, but the court said it was a question of fact, and so therefore the four-year statute applied for purposes of the motion to dismiss.
But does it somehow defeat your claims, or your client's claims, if Forlis is no longer a party to the proceeding, if we were to say that the court did not err?
Well, the Superior Court dismissed her from the case since she was an unnecessary party, and our argument was that was incorrect because she's a necessary relief defendant.
I'm then saying, how does that damage your case? I mean, do you still have the same arguments? I mean,
if the statute of limitation, if this court doesn't accept our arguments about why the statute of limitations should be told and all that sort of thing, then she's a necessary party because the four-year statute would apply, and so the plaintiff would have claims against her.
Thank you for clarifying that.
And if there's no other questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Chaz Workin. I represent the Appalese Mesa Public School District and Superintendent Forlis. As this court seems to recognize, the dispositive issues here are those of standing and statute of limitations. As to Ms. Walden, she lacks standing because she is, in essence, suing on the basis that alleging that the guidelines are unlawful. She doesn't allege any particular or distinct injury. What she claims is a generalized harm. That does not give her standing. Her fallback position is that she has standing because she was denied the right to vote. As Judge McMurdy has recognized, uh, the guidelines were adopted before she was ever elected to office. In any event, she does not allege in the complaint that she was denied the right to vote. She only alleges that the guidelines were never voted upon. I see a significant difference between those two possible allegations. She only makes the one allegation. The guidelines were never voted on. And they are guidelines. They are labeled as guidelines. It is argued that there was no policy that permitted these guidelines to be adopted, and that all policies have to be voted on. But something that's overlooked is in the papers attached to the First Amended complaint. If you look at the guidelines themselves, at pages 43 and 44, the school in those guidelines recites the desire, the policy of the district to have a learning environment that's free from discrimination, including on the basis of sex, which includes gender identity. So these guidelines were adopted to implement that policy of providing a learning environment free of any discrimination. And as
so I'm going to stop you right there, because I realize that we've really focused on standing and statute of limitations, but you're bringing this up. How does not notifying a parent as to what's going on with their child prevent discrimination in a school?
Well, that's a very good question. And it
might be need to be answered on remand if we find that somebody has standing to raise it. It's a brilliant question.
I only asked it because you brought it up. I don't know that it's relevant to what we're really talking about. But
yeah, the merits are not before us.
Over it.
No, they're not. I said it's a good question. You had a superlative. The guidelines give the child a choice as to whether they want the parent to be informed. And, it's the child that's suffering the discrimination, not the parent. It's the child who's in the school environment and, is being subjected to, whatever, abuse, harassment. And so my best answer for you is that the guidelines, by giving the child that choice, further the goal of preventing discrimination. But I don't think that's a dispositive issue here today. Going back to where, before your question, and to the point that one of you raised, the issue here is, and a sub-issue here is whether Walden has the right to vote on the implementation of a policy. And again, the policy is to prevent discrimination. The guidelines implement that policy. And Walden may disagree with the policy. She may disagree with the guidelines. She may disagree with the implementation. But she doesn't have standing to challenge that as a sole member of the board. Just being a member of the board doesn't give her standing. And this case is not like that of the Adams case or the Brewer case, which are cited in the briefs, which with much different circumstances. So I want to touch on Toma versus Fontas because it was brought up for the first time in the reply brief, although it was a case decided by our Supreme Court before the opening brief was filed. I've not heard the argument repeated here this morning that there is institutional standing for Ms. Walden, but since it's in the briefs, I would point out that in Toma, that was a case of the legislature suing as a body. not any individual like Walden suing to challenge a statute or what have you. So this case is very distinguishable from Toma on for various reasons, including that Walden was suing as an individual. She wasn't authorized by the board to sue the board. And it's not a vote nullification case. Again, the complaint, and we are operating within the confines of the allegations of the First Amendment complaint. There is no allegation in there about a denial of a right to vote, no allegation that she requested a vote and that it was refused or denied, simply the allegation that these guidelines were never voted on, as I've already said. And Toma didn't involve a legislator's right to vote. It involved the effect of that vote, which would be, as you're probably familiar with the case, the vote would be a nullity because, as the statute was worded, anything changing what the Clean Election Commission did would be of no effect. So Toma is not applicable here, and its theory of institutional standing was not alleged in the complaint. It was not argued below. It didn't come up until the reply brief and should not be considered. So turning into Jane Doe's lack of standing, she also challenges these guidelines as unlawful and wants a declaratory judgment to that effect. But I think it even if she has standing, there was no actual controversy at the time, if she ever could have standing, there was no actual controversy at the time she filed suit or joined in this suit. According to the allegations of the complaint, there no longer was an actual controversy.
Did she have to wait for the board to, I mean, not the board, excuse me, wait for somebody within the school district to apply the guidelines before she can bring an action since they've applied the guidelines previously? I mean, they applied the guidelines. She objected. They remedied her objection, but they didn't rescind the guidelines. And I read her complaint in generic terms that she just doesn't want these guidelines to apply to her daughter, period.
I'm not quite sure I heard the last part.
She doesn't want the guidelines to apply to her daughter going forward.
She does not want them, but they aren't being applied to her.
How does she know that there's a secretive element involved in application of the guidelines?
Well, according to her own allegations, the issues with the daughter have been completely resolved, and that the female child at the time of filing this First Amendment complaint identified as a female. So the guidelines were having no effect at that time, according to these.
But how does she know that going forward they won't? I mean, she was told by the school at first that you know, her wishes were going to be observed and that she thought the issue was resolved. And then moving forward, she finds out in a very public forum that the school was still calling her daughter with a male name. So how does she know for sure, without the policy going away in total, that it is resolved?
Well, then she's asking for an advisory declaratory judgment. She doesn't have it's speculative, Your Honor, in a word.
How is it speculative under the Parents' Bill of Rights? To me, that's the elephant in the room here, is the Parents' Bill of Rights. I don't know if I've ever read a statute that's more broadly worded than that statutory scheme, and it plainly says any action that interferes or usurps a parent's fundamental rights is fodder for a lawsuit. Doesn't it say that, counsel?
Okay. Any action that affects the parent.
Interferes with or usurps,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, but we don't have here the allegation that is, in fact, happening. We have only speculation that it might happen in the future. And so the statute has been cited to you, I think, subsection E, giving standing, but that by itself doesn't support a lawsuit. You also have to have some wrong to go along with it, or you have to have some justiciable controversy here. We don't have that.
Well, okay, at the time of the lawsuit, I mean, again, in this, I think this is closely tied to statute of limitations, too, because, I mean, the incident involving at the February, I think, the February IEP meeting, where several teachers said that they were still using the male name, and then also it was announced in how was that not any action? It was also announced at the school orchestra or the in front of the audience. How is that not any action? Are we looking at the, today whether there's an actual controversy? Are we looking at the time the Second Amendment complaint or First Amendment complaint? Aren't we looking at that time?
We are.
Because you're not arguing anything on appeal has made this moot. Not events that have
come. No, but I it was moot in the sense that at the time of the filing of the complaint, the daughter's issues had been resolved. She's has resumed identifying as a female.
So just as I understand and follow up on Judge McMurray's question earlier, so no one in the district can challenge these guidelines until their student has been, well, first of all, they don't know what they don't know. But once they do know, I mean, they have to wait for an injury. I mean, does that square with, like, does that make sense as a public policy? Like, let's wait till my child is injured, and then I'll come forward and I'll have the right to sue.
Well, of course it makes sense, and I think that we find that thought permeating the law and statute of limitations very broadly across all manner of cases.
Not necessarily. I mean, you can't think of cases where rights have been potentially going to be violated on a constitutionality of a statute, and it's challenged if the person has a valid interest in that statute?
Well, does she have a valid interest when she concedes that the issues regarding her daughter have been resolved and the daughter is Megan still being, is back to being Megan?
And if she conceded that, I'm not sure we would be here.
Well,
I'm assuming that at the time she filed the complaint, she did not believe that there was an ongoing concern with her daughter. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
But she is also concerned that given the length of time it took the school to resolve the issue, that she wants an injunction or a declaratory judgment that prevents the school from implementing the policy for to her daughter going forward. That if Megan should change her mind and again and decide she wants to be Michael, that she wants to be notified.
Well, if that happens, well, first of all, I don't think that your phrase, given the length of time, it was a matter of months. But
as a parent, I'm assuming that a matter of months when it relates to your child is a long time.
All right.
You disagree with that?
I'm not going to argue that. Okay. It's subjective. But she learned more than a year before joining in this First Amendment complaint sufficient facts. She had sufficient knowledge and information to use the phraseology from Walk versus Ring, which is cited and quoted by appellant, to know that she had a cause of action, yet she did not pursue it.
So I'm going to ask this question, and I'm sorry, did he answer your question? Is it the school district's position that when she knew, she should have taken action? And the reason I ask that is, are you suggesting that we should adopt a rule from this court saying that anytime a parent has a concern, that they should file suit to make sure they meet the statute of limitations? I can't believe that's what the school district would want.
No, that's not how I would phrase it. Anytime they have a concern, they should file suit. No. But when that concern is then, you know, let's say ripens, that there are events that are causing more than concern, that are actually having an effect on the parent and or the child, then the clock starts to run. And the clock doesn't run when the last event occurs. It starts to run when the would-be plaintiff has sufficient knowledge and information to know that there's been a wrong and who committed it.
Well, there is a theory that says it does go to the last event, and it's known as a continuing harm theory. And why wouldn't that apply in a situation like this? I mean, she found out she had been working with the school district not to have them do it, and it was almost a year later when she found out they still had not remedied the situation that they had promised her.
Well, I would argue that the continuing harm, this case has been likened to a trespass case, that it's nothing like that. She learned of an event that was within a year prior to filing, but that is, simply in addition to what she already knew and a claim that she was resting on.
But Mr. Morgan, if she had not done anything and she heard that at that event, she would have an actionable suit at that time.
That would give rise to the claim at that time. But when you, in the aggregate, again, a word found in Walk versus Ring, when you add that to what she already knew and the inaction of Jane Doe, the clock has started to run and ran out.
Are you aware of any cases that have applied Walk v. Ring type analysis, in other words, tort law analysis, to this type of an action, where they're not seeking damages, no damages are on the table, as far as I understand, purely prospective relief, wanting either an injunction or mandamus or declaratory relief, correct? I mean, are you aware of any case that's applied Walk v. Ring where purely prospective relief is sought by the plaintiff against the government?
I am not aware, as I stand here, of such a case, but I...
Would you agree that it's a little that the law is not clear on that yet? On whether 820 applies to purely prospective relief?
No, I would not.
You say it's clear?
I'm straining to remember the names of the two cases that cited in the answering brief. City of Chandler is one of them, I believe.
City of Chandler and Radio Rogers. I can't remember.
Thank you.
Yep, but I read those, and they don't involve purely prospective relief. Unfortunately, there is a case I found, just in full disclosure, I think from 2014, which is not citable, from some of my colleagues said, they seem to say fairly clearly that it would apply, 820 would apply to solely to a deck action, but again, that's not something either you or we can cite.
Okay.
I'd like to go back to a question that we've discussed amongst ourselves, and that is the dismissal of the superintendent.
Yes.
It seems to me, since these are her policies, is the board saying that they are defending those policies? I mean, no, excuse me, guidelines. That they're defending the guidelines, so there's no need for both defendants to be available? Because it seems to me that since the board has taken no action on the guidelines, aren't these the superintendent's guidelines?
Well, I understand that the superintendent promulgated these. The superintendent serves at the pleasure of the board. And if the board has a policy against discrimination, superintendent adopts some guidelines in furtherance of that policy. And if the board doesn't like it, the board can take some action, which hasn't happened here.
We're at time. Do you need some more
no,
time?
No, that's fine.
Oh, darn, I wanted to speak to Judge Brown.
Do you want to hear the answer?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, we'll add a minute.
I don't need that long. In response to your questions about other cases and prospective relief, I'm reminded of a law professor whose name I can't remember. I was in class that day. He said the life of the law is reason. And I think the reasoning applies. You may not have a case yet. This could be your opportunity. but the reasoning of Walk v. Ring and others, Rogers, Chandler, applies.
Thank you.
Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you, counsel. If you can add a minute for appellant, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I wanted to address the issue of the ongoing harm. In the cases that counsel talked about were trespass cases. In a trespass sort of situation, so long as the land is being trespassed upon, the owner of that land is suffering harm. They lose the enjoyment of their land. Children are much more precious and important than land, and the relationship with a child is the same sort of ongoing harm that a parent would suffer is way worse than harm to land. And so we would urge this court to consider that same sort of harm in a case of parental-child relationships, that the same sort of ongoing harm should apply. As far as prospective relief, I talked about the declaratory judgment as being an open question, but it really is an open question for any sort of prospective relief, and the same reasoning that applies for declaratory judgment would apply for everything. So we'd urge the court to consider this as a great vehicle to clarify that, and for all the reasons that Your Honors have talked about, that it's a difficult issue if a parent has that one-year statute, that there's so many issues, and to be frank, this is not an appellate record, but we had multiple parents reach out to us, and they were afraid to put their names out there in a case, and so there's a lot of people suffering with this policy. On the issue of the guidelines implementing a policy and therefore never a vote should have been taken, so therefore no standing, that's really a merits issue. Whether the guidelines are policy or not, that goes to the merits, and so that can't be used to defeat standing. That's a clear principle of law. On the issue of the guidelines having been adopted before Governing Board Member Walden came onto the board, I made the analogy to adverse possession. It doesn't apply in this sort of situation. And another policy reason why that should not matter for standing for Governing Board Member Walden is it creates perverse incentives. If, for example, a board is a lame duck board, they could collude with the superintendent to adopt policies, and then the new board members wouldn't have the ability to sue on them. There's all sorts of...
Oh, wait a minute. That's not true. The new board can simply call for a vote and eliminate the guidelines or the policy.
Correct, depending on the makeup of the board. But in these sorts of issues, these controversial issues, oftentimes boards are reluctant to publicly vote on these issues. And sometimes there's board members, there might be, if it were brought before a board vote initially, they wouldn't have voted on it. But if it's a secret policy that they can continue, that they won't be accountable to the voters for, then they can keep that policy. There's all sorts of procedural games you could play with the makeups of boards. You know, whether if it's a five-member board with two are against, two are in favor, and one's kind of in the middle, it creates perverse incentives for that sort of gamesmanship
to happen. It's still the board's action, whether it be 4-1, 3-2, it's still a board action. And she is not trumping the board action. She is just a member of that board.
Well, in this case, it's not a board action because it's a superintendent-imposed policy. What I'm saying is that they could collude for the superintendent to create policies that would bind future boards, policies the board never voted on. And just really quick, I wanted to talk about the Toma case and the individual rights of members of bodies to vote. We cited in our brief on pages 3-4 a host of persuasive cases from out of Arizona where city councils and school boards members were found to have standing because they were denied the right to vote or because they were forced to violate their oaths of office. And we would urge the court to adopt that reasoning here in the situation where that hasn't been heard. And absolutely, Toma is about the institution. But as I talked about, when the procedures have been completely ignored, there's an individual right. The members have been harmed. And then on the declaratory judgment standing issue, the standards are decreased for that as well. We didn't really get into that, but there was no need for palpable harm there. So thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We want to thank you both for your presentation today. We appreciate your briefing. We'll take this matter under advisement and issue a written decision in due course, and we will just reset the courtroom. We'll leave the bench while we reset the courtroom for the next argument. Court is adjourned.